Vygotsky's book, Requiem for the American Dream, Principles of Concentration of Wealth and Power, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. You are listening to the Deep Blues Hour here on WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Steve, your host for the next 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear from Aaron Burton, recorded live at Buddy Guy's Legends Club in Chicago back in 1996. B. Houston as well from 1970 from his disc called The Butler, plus Bucca White, and He's a Sleepy Man. It's all coming up here in this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. Let's get it kicked off with Mr. Pinetop Perkins from his release called Born in the Delta. Here he is with Every Day I Have the Blues. It's Pinetop Perkins here on the Deep Blues Hour.
See me worrying, darling, I swear you I hate to lose. Nobody worried, nobody seem to care. Nobody worrying, as nobody seem to care. Speaking of bad luck and trouble, so I really have had my share. Thank you.
There are only so many major news stories each year, and we have one of them today. And this is actually, I would argue, one of the biggest news stories of the decade. We've been waiting for the Supreme Court's decision on abortion rights, two cases that historically establish the right to an abortion in most cases in the United States. Those are Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The Supreme Court, we knew sometime in the next few weeks, maybe by the end of June, would issue a decision on a Mississippi abortion ban, which would, in practice, overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, depending on what the court decides. And that decision has been leaked. It has not been announced by the Supreme Court, but it has been leaked, and reputably so. And if nothing changes, the Supreme Court will be overturning abortion rights as a federal, in most cases, right, sending it back to the states, plunging many states back into, should we call it medieval times? Should we call it the Dark Ages? Should we call it the 1850s, the 1950s? There are actually two cases here. Most people know about Roe v. Wade, but there's two cases, Roe v. Wade, as well as the 1992 Planned Parenthood decision, Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Now, Politico got a copy of the draft opinion, and this is a major scoop. It really is, and there are conservatives mad about the fact that this leaked, but obtaining this is a major scoop. And the quote from the majority opinion, believed to be ready to go in a few weeks, is from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, where he writes, quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. And far from bringing about a national settlement of the abortion issue, Roe and Casey have inflamed debate and deepened division. Now, before we go forward with the analysis on the assumption that this decision isn't going to change, we should put on record, in case things do change, that sometimes justices will circulate draft opinions and there's still revisions and changes and sometimes horse trading for votes. I mean, things happen. You would think that that doesn't happen at the Supreme Court, but it does. And up until days before it's made official, opinions can change. But right now, Roe v. Wade goes bye-bye. Planned Parenthood v. Casey goes bye-bye. Now, on the issue of blame, because I've gotten a ton of messages from people about who do we blame here? Do we blame the people that didn't vote for Hillary and all this different stuff? Listen, it's like when there's I'm not even going to make any analogies. We mostly blame the Supreme Court justices who voted this way. Okay, but we primarily blame them. And when it comes to the Supreme Court, then you go, well, why are they there? And so you go to Trump. Trump's choices are what made this a plausible reality. And we predicted and we were worried that it would happen. And it looks like it's happening. So we blame the justices and we blame the president who put them there, who's Donald Trump. Well, why was Trump there? We mostly blame the people who voted for Donald Trump and put him in this position. But we also say, hey, as an instructive element, as something we should remember, those people who said Hillary, Trump, it's all the same. It's all the same. I'm going to stay home, or I'm going to write in whoever, because they said Supreme Court, I don't care about the Supreme Court. When I was here saying, you realize what could happen if Trump wins and gets to pick Supreme Court justices, right? And some of you said, oh, I don't care about that. That's not a big deal. Well, there is some responsibility there as well. But most of it is the people who voted for Trump and Trump and the Supreme Court justices that he put there. We don't have to go crazy fighting about it. We just have to remember, in case this comes up again, if you didn't vote for Hillary in 2016, this was the risk you assumed. I'm not saying you're a bad person, but this was the risk you assumed. You thought it was worth, I don't know, sending a message to the DNC or whatever, and that's totally fine. That's your right. But this was the risk you assumed, and now this is where we are. Now, the one thing here that could be a silver lining, I've been saying Democrats are heading towards a disastrous and potentially historic defeat in the midterms in November. It's possible that this might be what lights a fire under the left to say, wow, now we see the repercussions. We've got to get out there and vote. I'll come back to that. Let's go back a little bit. We often talk about how all Supreme Court nominees play coy when asked about abortion, and they say, well, it might come before the court and I can't prejudge and all these different things. Just as a reminder, here's Samuel Alito back at his confirmation hearing in 2006, kind of dancing around the question of, is abortion constitutionally protected? He said it was not in an earlier writing before being nominated. Here's how he danced around this question during his confirmation hearings.
Specter then brought up the often cited letter Alito wrote in 1985 in applying for a job in the Reagan White House, stating the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion.
Do you agree with that statement today, Judge Alito?
Well, that was a correct statement of what I thought in 1985 from my vantage point in 1985, and that was as a line attorney in the Department of Justice in the Reagan administration. Today, if the issue were to come before me, if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed and the issue were to come before me, then I would approach the question with an open mind, and I would listen to the arguments.
So you would approach it with an open mind, notwithstanding your 1985 statement?
Absolutely, Senator. That was a statement that I made at a prior period of time when I was performing a different role. And as I said yesterday, when someone becomes a judge, you really have to put aside the things that you did as a lawyer at prior points in your legal career and think about legal issues the way a judge thinks about legal issues.
Here are Trump's three Supreme Court nominees, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, when Roe v. Wade and abortion precedent came up during their confirmation hearings.
Is Roe a super precedent?
How would you define super precedent? And I'm answering a lot of questions about Roe, which I think indicates that Roe doesn't fall in that category. And scholars across the spectrum say that doesn't mean that Roe should be overruled. But descriptively, it does mean that it's not a case that everyone has accepted and doesn't call for its overruling.
As a judge, it is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent, which itself is an important factor.
Senator, as the book explains, the Supreme Court of the United States has held in Roe versus Wade that a fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment. And the book explains that.
Do you accept that?
That's the law of the land. I accept the law of the land, Senator. Yes.
So everybody just kind of playing it off like, I don't know, you know, there's precedent. It's the law. I don't have any big desire to overturn Roe v. Wade. But now, if nothing changes, it will be gone. Go back to what Hillary Clinton said back in 2018. Where she said, quote, if Brett Kavanaugh becomes a Supreme Court justice, will he help gut or overturn Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion in America? Yes, of course he will. And she was right. And I am no fan of Hillary, but Hillary was right about many things, it turns out, in retrospect. This makes Donald Trump an extraordinarily consequential president. Trump, as far as we know personally, isn't even pro-life. Trump was vocally pro-choice until he was 68 years old. And then he ran as a Republican and had to come up with this explanation. Well, I met a kid I liked, and the mom said at one point she thought about aborting, and so then I was pro-life. Nobody believes it, if you're thinking critically. But it doesn't change that Trump may now be the most consequential anti-abortion president in history at this point in time. A totally clueless doofus. But he figured out a way to overturn Roe v. Wade, something I don't think he even cares about personally. This lets each state decide. Do we restrict abortion? Do we ban abortion? And I've said it isn't even really clear what Democrats could do to save the midterms. But this reality that states now could ban or restrict abortion in absolutely authoritarian retrograde ways, maybe it will help Democrats not get crushed in November. We talked about, what if Biden forgives some student loan debt? What about cannabis decriminalization? I don't know. This could be the thing. It is possible that this is exactly the earth-shattering wake-up call that might get people to go out and vote because they realize this is dark ages stuff. We're leaving the country to retrograde elements of society to run things. And this issue could potentially reshape the midterms, and we'll talk about that more. Protests are already surging. Police are setting up barriers at the Supreme Court. And this could inspire all sorts of new voters, apathetic voters. We just can't say yet. Now, what do people do in red states? Does everyone with common sense leave the red states to go to the safe haven of blue states? I don't know. Do the leftists flood the red states to make them no longer red? And it is really quite the situation. And, you know, for us who live in blue states like New York, much will probably not change. That's a reality. But for many people in other parts of the country, it will be a disaster. Now, what's next? What's next? Because some of the people against abortion are also against interracial marriage. Some of them are against divorce for religious reasons, or at least claim to be. Some of them are against gay adoption. Some of them are against gay marriage. They want it to be legal to fire people for their gender identity or sexual orientation, which, by the way, is still legal in more than 20 states. They want to be able to whatever. And once they discover that you can take away established rights from people if you put the right people on the court and do the right things at the state level to get a case in front of the Supreme Court, why would they stop here? They're not going to. That is for damn sure. So we are going backwards. And next, I want to talk a little bit about the reaction from MAGA World to what we have learned overnight. Okay, so a leaked decision, Politico obtaining the draft decision. The Supreme Court, unless something changes, will be overturning Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. This will end federal abortion rights. It will push it to the states. Many states will outright ban abortion. I told you yesterday, Oklahoma passing a 6-week abortion ban. That's basically a total ban. Most women don't know they're pregnant until at least 4 to 5 weeks. A 6-week abortion ban is just an abortion ban. So let's look at some reactions. I want to start with radical Trumpist Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. She started crying when she heard about the decision. Let's take a look at that video.
I just want to make an announcement, and I'm sorry I'm overwhelmed with emotion because this is the best news of our lifetime. The Supreme Court has voted to overturn abortion rights. There's a draft opinion out now to overturn Roe versus Wade, and this is a great victory. It's a great victory for God and the unborn who have been innocently slain for years, my entire lifetime. And I'll just read this. It says Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. I just want to.
Okay. Now, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is completely out of her mind. I think she's nuts. I think she's a horrible person. But we have to understand, if you believe abortion is murder, right? If you believe that getting an abortion at 7 weeks is the same as a cold-blooded assassination, it would be logical that you would react like this. And so I think she's nuts for a whole bunch of different reasons, and I disagree with her view about abortion completely. But let's understand that if you believed that, this is kind of a logical reaction. The God stuff is an extra layer. Like, without the God stuff, I guess you could believe the same thing. But so that's Marjorie Taylor Greene. Laura Ingraham says to women who want an abortion, just move to a different state.
This was always shaky.
This was a state issue. And we
and
have
Ruth
to say.
Bader Ginsburg said it was shaky and bad.
Well, and I everyone has to remember tonight, like before everybody freaks out, that this is now going to be determined by you, the people.
Yeah.
Like you could live in New York and you say, look, remember New York did that standing ovation in Albany? Yeah. You want to know what sick is? It's not safe, legal, and rare anymore. In New York, you get a standing ovation for having abortion up until basically the baby, you know, is out of the womb.
Okay. So the reality, of course, is a lot of people can't afford to move. I mean, listen, the same people who might be in a situation where they might want to seek an abortion and they would have trouble paying for that, you think they can afford to move to a different state in order to get it? I mean, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Now, Laura Ingraham is aware that there are some on the left saying maybe this will inspire the left to get out and vote in November and it could save the midterm for Democrats. She doesn't agree, though.
The left is going into the stratosphere tonight. They're going nuts. They know their entire facade, everything they fought for. This is the die, the hill that they'll die on. They're worried that it's all going to come crumbling down. And they think that somehow this leak is going to be a gift that could rescue them for the midterms. Well, the thinking is misguided.
All right. So Laura Ingraham says this won't save Democrats in November. Republican Trumpist Congresswoman Lauren Boebert put out a tweet in response saying, if your response to the Supreme Court news is to dust off your stupid pink hat from 2016 and go march to a support infanticide, reevaluate your entire life. And then lastly, Fox host Tomi Lahren says Democrats are going to do their own insurrection over this.
Talking about this leak, do you think that this was an intimidation tactic?
Absolutely an intimidation tactic and also a distraction tactic here. I think that the only way the Democrats have a chance in November is if they rile everybody up, get people to the polls with these emotional, cultural issues, of course.
Now, what's funny about that is it's Republicans who use contrived cultural issues to get people to the polls, like critical race theory. This issue of abortion is a real issue. It's about precedent. It's about law. It's actually about a Supreme Court decision. When you have the Supreme Court actually dealing with something, it's not a contrived issue. The contrived issues are on their side.
Abortion is one that's going to be very high emotion, very intense for the country. This is their effort to distract from everything that's going wrong and play to the heartstrings of those, especially on the left, that this issue is so important to. And I think we're going to see the summer 2020 reignited with protests and, you know, dare I say, an insurrection. I know that's a dirty word, but I think we're going to see a lot more to come this week.
I don't believe that we are going to see an insurrection or a coup attempt. I think we will hopefully see Democrats say, wow, look at what it took a few years, right? It was, I don't know, Trump, Hillary, I don't know. And then here's Trump and he gets one pick to the court and then he gets a second pick and then he gets a third pick. And then Mississippi says we're going to ban abortion and it's appealed. And then it goes to the court and, well, we'll hear from the court at some point. And the court says, Roe v. Wade is gone, folks. Roe v. Wade is gone. That's it. It took some years, but that's the way it ultimately worked. Let me know if you believe this changes the outlook for the midterms. Find me on Twitter at DPacman. So let's talk about Vladimir Putin. As many of you remember, we started talking about the Putin's health story a while ago. At the very start of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, we got emails from a couple of doctors who said, Putin doesn't look good. Putin looks sick. We could be looking at any number of different conditions. And I said to all of you, this is speculation. This is mere idle speculation. We then saw about 10 days ago, this video of Vladimir Putin where he is sitting at a table, he's gripping the table almost for support. He's like pushed back against the chair. He's tapping his toe. His left hand is shaky. And this renewed speculation that there could be something very seriously wrong with Vladimir Putin. In the last 48 hours, a story came out in the British tabloid The Sun that Putin is going to be having cancer surgery. And I didn't come to you with the story because The Sun is simply not an appropriate source for our show. That story now has made it into the New York Post. Now, I still come to you with caution and I say the New York Post is basically the print version of Fox News. It's still not a slam dunk that the truth is exactly as is being reported here. But this is now becoming mainstream enough that since we've been talking about it at this point for over a month, I want to talk about it with you. The New York Post story says Putin to undergo cancer surgery and transfer power to the ex-FSB chief. Russian President Vladimir Putin is set to undergo cancer surgery and temporarily hand over power to a hardline former federal police chief, according to a new report. Putin will transfer control of Russia's government to Nikolai Petrushev, head of the Russian Federal Police's Security Council, while he is incapacitated during and after the procedure, according to a video from the mysterious Telegram channel General SVR. The channel is purportedly run by a former Russian Foreign Intel Service lieutenant general, reported that Putin has been told by doctors he must undergo an operation. The anticipated surgery and recovery are expected to incapacitate Putin for a short time, according to the unconfirmed report. Putin is unlikely to agree to hand over power for a longer period of time. I will say that this is the worst option. Patrushev is an outright villain, no better than Putin. Moreover, he's more cunning and I would say more insidious than Putin. If he comes to power, Russians' problems will only multiply. So is this true? We don't really know. We don't really know. But what we do know is at this point, speculation from doctors, video evidence, and this kind of strange report all are saying the exact same thing. And whether this is responsible for Putin's actions in Ukraine is a different story altogether. And the reason that the speculation is related to the invasion of Ukraine would be, well, if he believes that he's going to die, he may try to go out in a sort of final blaze of trying to restore glory to the former Soviet Union as he still idolizes it. Or it may be a side effect of medication that is making him irrational. There are also unconfirmed reports that this is actually a cognitive issue and dementia. It's wild speculation at the micro level, but the macro story continues to be more and more different types of stories about Putin's health. So all we can do is wait and see. And I don't even know that there's more to say about it, but the story creeping more and more into the mainstream. There is a new book coming out from Donald Trump's former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper. In the book, Esper says that Donald Trump wanted to have Black Lives Matter protesters shot. Where do we start? Axios reporting, scoop, Esper says Trump wanted to shoot protesters. This is from Mike Allen. Mike Allen, a long history of very important scoops. The book is called The Sacred Oath. Former Defense Secretary Mark Esper charges in a memoir out May 10 that former President Trump said when demonstrators were filling the streets around the White House after the death of George Floyd, quote, can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something. The book A Sacred Oath contains vivid first-person revelations by a top cabinet member, bolstering outsider accounts of extreme dysfunction in the Trump White House. Esper was fired by Trump after the 2020 election. That moment in the first week of June 2020, quote, was surreal, sitting in front of the Resolute desk inside the Oval Office with this idea weighing heavily in the air and the president red-faced and complaining loudly about protests in D.C. Esper goes on to say, the good news, this wasn't a difficult decision, not shooting protesters. The bad news, I had to figure out a way to walk Trump back without creating the mess I was trying to avoid. This book was vetted at the highest levels of the Pentagon. Some of the four-star generals who vetted the book or reviewed it witnessed what Esper witnessed. There's a few different things here. First of all, shoot people for their speech. I thought they were for free speech. For all of the First Amendment stuff they claim to be all about, Trump saying, well, what about shooting people exercising free speech rights? I want to go into a different direction with this, though. I find it almost traitorous that many of these former Trump administration officials wait sometimes years to tell us about this stuff until they can monetize it. I would argue that it was Mark Esper's duty to go public with this when it was happening. If a president wants to shoot protesters for protesting, then it is almost as outrageous to stay quiet about it until you can make money from it in a book. I get why they do it. They all do it. It's not unique to Mark Esper, but it is fundamentally not loyalty to what is best for the country. It is a loyalty to what is best for his wallet. And I get it. I know why they are doing it. But this is so extreme and so outrageous that you could make the case that it borders on treason not to immediately blow the whistle publicly on something like this. Now, let's be, you know, as charitable as possible. Is it possible that Mitch McConnell and the RNC told Esper to sit on this stuff? Let's see how far the January 6th committee goes. Let's wait before you. It's possible, but there's no evidence of that. And it doesn't seem particularly likely. I disagree with conservatism, But this idea, shoot protesters, it's not conservatism. I'm not praising conservatism, and I disagree with conservatism, but this is not conservatism. These ideas are neo-reactionary authoritarianism, and it's Republicans sort of resorting to the absolute worst human traits, and some of them seem to lack the intellectual capacity to turn these things into reality. Trump thought about shooting protesters. He didn't do it. His Secretary of Defense wasn't willing to do it, as far as he claims. I guess Trump just wasn't able to make it a reality. A less incompetent person at the helm might actually be able to get some of this stuff to become a reality. And that's why the idea of, what about DeSantis, a less incompetent but just as dangerous version of Trump as a possible Republican nominee, that's why it's so dangerous and horrifying. So that's the latest from Esper. I don't plan on buying the book. I don't read any of these types of books. I've got too much other stuff to read that I find more interesting, but not a revelation that I would doubt. It is in line with everything we've seen from Donald Trump, but Esper should have gone public earlier with this. We'll have more on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Professor Michael Gambone, who teaches history at Kutztown University of Pennsylvania, specializing in modern America, also is author of the forthcoming book, Modern Conspiracies in America, Separating Fact from Fiction. It's out in less than 2 weeks. Really great to have you on. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a great opportunity. And I appreciate it.
Yeah, so this is such an important topic right now in the United States of America, kind of in the era of COVID vaccines, Trumpism, flat earth, the 2020 election. We could kind of go on and on and on. We've talked quite a bit about general techniques and strategies to talk to people about beliefs that may not be based in fact. But I think we can all kind of feel that there's a difference between the belief that tax cuts for the rich are good for the economy, kind of in one bucket, and on the other side, the belief that, I don't know, there is a secret plot to create the COVID pandemic in order to create an opportunity to vaccinate people, which will then allow mind control and, you know, on and on and on. We can feel that there's sort of some difference between those two things. Can you first talk a little bit about the difference between beliefs that might just be wrong and what we would characterize as a conspiracy theory?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, when I started teaching this class, I really wanted it to be a research class. I mean, how do you figure out how to apply a basic template for logic? So what I always tell the students, I said, you have a claim. It has to be matched with a proof. It has to be. And then we can talk about degrees of evidence. So we just finished up Sandy Hook and QAnon in my class. And one of the tells that you have is if you have somebody making a claim simply followed by more claims, with no proof in the, you know, following in the wake of that, then that's a huge flag. So, and that's what you tend to always want. I tell them, tune your ear to that. You know, when you hear this kind of hopscotching, gish gallop, you know, moving along the surface type of approach, if it has no depth, then that's a problem. So we can talk about tax cuts and economics, fine. But if you're going to claim that a microchip was in the, you know, COVID vaccination, show me the proof. And the other way I look at it, if you have the big claims, the giant global conspiracies, big claim requires big proof. It's the same, you know, basically the same idea, but it's just a bigger threshold.
Is there a shortcut not to changing people's minds? We'll get later to the changing of minds, but to being able to ascertain whether you're speaking to someone who's open to revising their views?
I think so. I think you start, you know, I think one of the things I said in the book is you apply the 80-20 rule. I mean, you should be starting off by listening more than talking. And I think that's a skill, unfortunately, we're losing in civil discourse. And that's something I'm trying to teach in class, you know, to sit back and listen. Because teachers are the worst at this. We're talkers. We have captive audiences. So first thing, listen, see where they're coming from. One of the key things you need to know is the context. I mean, what are, you know, where are they? Where do they live? And so on. You're basically trying to build a profile of the person you're talking to, and just and simply, you know, you don't want to go right to a quick conclusion and dismiss them. So that's what you're always doing in any conversation.
There's the other kind of side to this, and I hesitate to ever say there's another side to things when we're really talking about kind of one-sided circumstances, but sometimes you will hear the claim from some who assert conspiratorial beliefs that what you just accept everything everybody tells you. You always accept the official story. You accept what the government says. Medicine has been wrong. Science has been wrong. Governments have lied, et cetera. What's the best way to kind of handle that idea and approach that?
Yeah, I think I tell them, and I have a lot of criminal justice majors, but I think in general, treat this like you would if you're on a jury. So you have a burden of proof, but one thing you're never going to have is 100% certainty. So you have to reach that level to say, is it 51% enough? Do I need more? So that's how you're measuring this. And also, we were just talking about this this week. Evidence evolves. You have examples where, you know, in some of these, you know, conspiracies, you're going to have revelations that might take decades, or technology will change and you'll have better ways to analyze something. So patience is also a virtue for both of those things. And that's, again, you're trying to teach Americans patience. That's an ongoing enterprise.
Do you address the idea of sometimes one might assert a certain belief, not because they actually believe it, but because it signals that they're part of a team? And I'll give an example of that. You know, after the 2020 election, there was polling done about, do you believe Trump won? And the numbers among Republicans at the time were quite high. I think in the immediate aftermath, it was like 57%, and that number has waned over time. But within that 57%, presumably there were some what we might call true believers who literally believe Trump actually won. But then there are others for whom claiming it signals support for Trump or identifies them with the team, for lack of a better term. Where does that figure in to the studies and the work that you do?
I think I've used a lot of polling and a lot of analysis of polling, especially by an author named Berinsky. You have, you know, influencers. I mean, that's a new term, but you've always had people who lead opinions because they're trusted, they have agency, they're public officials. So people will tend to rely on that, and they can guide that or they can abuse it. I think Joe McCarthy is a classic example. But one of the things that came up in QAnon, you know, of all the reading I did, Wired Magazine had a great story on, you know, how QAnon is like an alternate reality game. So what you have is you have a universe, basically it's world building. So you've got certainty and rewards. So within that group, you have that, you know, recognition. And I think what that lends people in very uncertain times, and this is very historical. I mean, you could have said this in 1919 or today. It gives people an anchor to hang on to in a very, you know, difficult, fearful, uncertain time. So whether I'm a leader or a follower, I mean, there are uses for these things that, you know, can be manipulated.
Yeah, that you touched on something which we've talked about before, which is if you take something like Sandy Hook as an example, or 9/11 maybe are good examples of this. Sometimes it seems like one of the primary motivating factors in getting people to choose one of these assertions rather than what we might call the official empirically based version of the story is that the randomness with which bad things happen in the world is extraordinarily unsettling. And so for some folks, it's almost more pacifying to believe it wasn't a random thing that could have happened at any time. It was planned. It was deliberate. And there's more certainty in the world. Is that an important psychologically motivating factor for more than just a few of these?
Absolutely. I use a book by Rob Brotherton called Suspicious Minds, and he talks about the messy desk test, where people instinctively want to impose order on something that's simple, but that applies to a lot of things in life. So rather than be overwhelmed, you make this construct, and it works toward intellectual values, but also, you know, you could say instinct, what you might seem as common sense. So one of the things we suspect is always threats, and we tend to associate these threats with the other. And it could, you know, usually, you know, the brand new immigrant. I mean, that's a classic nativist go-to in a lot of these conspiracies. You saw that in 16 with, you know, the 3 million boats. It's a constant drumbeat, even during COVID. Who's bringing COVID? Well, these other people, them. That's why when I first started the class, I looked at the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it's amazing how that keeps coming back in different forms, but it's basically the same thing. That's about as old a story as it gets, but I saw updates to this year. It's amazing.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about anti-Semitism. I, as a Jewish person myself, you know, I've been aware of anti-Semitism for as long as I can remember being aware of anything. And a lot of the modern conspiracy theories, sometimes much more subtly than others, go back to or have their roots in an anti-Semitic idea. You know, the idea of the other bringing disease. That's a classic anti-Semitic idea from, you know, 800, 900 years ago, at least. Globalist now, often used as a sort of catch-all for wealthy Jewish men, right? When we talk about, they talk about Soros, they talk about Klaus Schwab is a big one here. Can you talk a little bit about where the origins of so many of these things stemmed from anti-Semitism, and whether even some of the conspiracy theorists realize that?
I don't think they do, although it's been constantly pointed out. So for QAnon, you have, you know, the endless stories about blood drinking and child trafficking. And I the first thing I automatically think of is the blood libel, which goes back for centuries. So I think at the root of a lot of these conspiracies, and I think Richard Hofstadter pointed this out really well, you've got a moral judgment that you're making. You're posing a moral threat, not just a political or a social or an economic one. So you've got this group of identified outcasts that you're posing as a threat to the social order. And you can go very viscerally, you know, in the case of QAnon, with the children. So that's a very consistent theme, threats to children, whether it's the Middle Ages or right now. And we can always associate that with this, you know, labeled outcast group. It keeps reoccurring because it works. It's odd to see anyone's going to argue against protecting children. I mean, it's very altruistic, but it can be very easily distorted. And it is. I saw this during the Supreme Court nomination.
What do you make of flat Earth surging at a time when we have the most advanced technology we've ever had and the most sort of empirical means of ascertaining the real shape of a planet?
Well, we do chemtrails in class, so it's kind of in the same ballpark. One of the common themes I see in all these conspiracies is there are always complexities. I don't know too many people who know structural engineering enough to talk about 9/11 or epidemiology since 2020. So I think in all these things, what you have with like flat Earth is a way to simplify and take back an idea that experts control. And in the meantime, what you're doing is making enormous numbers of mistakes, but you have certainty and you don't care about the complexity. You're just basically bypassing it. I love talking about chemtrails and flat Earth because my science majors lose their minds when they look at some of the basic mistakes. But that goes back to, you know, things you can look up and assert, back to the education system and, you know, competing with the ability to oversimplify. That's kind of the tug of war you have going on with that.
So now let's talk about changing minds. We've had many different conversations with experts about how do you change minds? You know, the low hanging fruit is beating people over the head with facts is rarely effective. Showing empathy, listening a lot, as you point out, is effective. But still, we've not really found any significant shortcut. I mean, oftentimes you're talking about building a relationship with someone, not even over a period of hours, but often over days, weeks, months, or whatever the case may be. What is your sense of the most effective techniques to change minds?
You know, I'm an educator, obviously, and I've been doing this for a long time. And one of the devices I had set up was having, you know, a group of students assert a conspiracy and a group of students debunk the conspiracy. And we're training them in basic logic, facts, but also in civil discourse. So in combination, that's where I have some hope, because that's the thing you don't have really online. You have, you know, threads where the insults break out in seconds. And that's not the way that should work. I mean, the face-to-face version of this is the better way because, you know, outside the internet, that's the way people used to debate. And you can look somebody in the eye. I think it's a very hard thing to do. I think one of the things that struck me about the recent past, shows with a sense of humor who don't take themselves too seriously, are very effective. That's what Jon Stewart proved years ago. John Oliver does that still. I mean, you can say this stuff with a smile on your face and not the dark implications of disagreement. So part of its method, part of its structure. I'm going to keep working away at it as long as I'm teaching, which is going to be for more years than now. So we'll see.
When it comes to like assessing the, I'm going to use the word danger, but maybe it's not actually the right word. But when it comes to assessing the danger of widespread belief of a particular conspiracy theory, I think many of us can understand how, at least in a direct sense, there are some conspiracy theories, like, for example, the comet ping pong thing that led to an actual shooting. Whereas for many of us, we say flat Earth, it's comparatively more benign. Some experts we've interviewed say that's true, and yet it's rare that someone believes only one of these things, and flat Earth links to something else, and it links to anti-Semitism and all these different things. So let's try to put together sort of a theory of this. We can understand the differences between the immediate impacts of some of these conspiracy theories, but how do we evaluate them on some kind of spectrum?
I think one of the things I noticed with QAnon was that it was early on dismissed as lone actors, you know, on the fringe. And I think what obviously January 6th proved a lot of that wrong. The same systems where these beliefs can overlap and combine, you know, with whatever, you know, media platform you have, they're also the same places that these threats can organize themselves. And that's a huge concern because you can't really shut down social media. It's like playing electronic whack-a-mole. You can ban somebody from a platform, they'll just move to another one. So I'm really concerned after January 6th, when it comes to coordinating, acting, people will move on their convictions. And like you mentioned in the polling, these aren't small numbers of people. Even if you take the tiniest percentage, you still have a lot of people willing to act on what they're doing. And that really concerns me because there's, you know, the treatment of this is almost like a crusade. So in my own classroom, or, you know, I'm an election worker. I'll be at the polls in 2 weeks. I'm constantly worried about somebody showing up, you know, to try to make sure that the election's not stolen. I've been asked that question dozens of times in 2 years. So I do have concerns.
Let's talk a little bit about social media. In the book Technopoly, Neil Postman wrote that there's a sort of naivete in thinking that with any platform or technology, you can eliminate any of the bad uses of it and only be left with the sort of good. And I'm oversimplifying, but the idea that a platform, a technology comes with good and bad. And the question is finding a balance of sort of regulation and education that will maximize the good and minimize the bad. We can think about lots of great things about social media, and also it has made the spread of conspiracy theories and false beliefs rampant like wildfire. What should be a regulatory framework for some of these platforms?
Oh, that's a big question. So best example I have online is a website called Metabunk, which has moderated conversations. They do have standards, and it works. But how far that could be extended and spread, you know, throughout the entire internet, that's the problem. And I think you pointed out, I mean, where these things might appear in places you would have never suspected. The natural parenting community in QAnon, I mean, no one saw that, although you could see the elements after the fact. So it's a very hard thing to talk about, because the more you crank down on free speech, the more that you're going to have the reaction. And I think it becomes self-defeating after a point. I'm back to trying to, you know, the education part before they log on. I mean, that's where I'm looking at.
For me, the greatest immunizer to people falling for this stuff is you start teaching critical thinking and media literacy probably at age 11 or something like that.
Right. Well, and judging by this course has changed since I started, you know, back in 2016, I had 25 students. Right now I have 145.
Wow.
So this thing fills in within a couple of days every time I run it, and I run multiple sections now. So it might be like a factory for reason and rational thinking, I hope.
Right. That's the dream. And the book is forthcoming in less than 2 weeks. It's Modern Conspiracies in America, Separating Fact from Fiction. I've pre-ordered it on Amazon already. I encourage the audience to do the same. We've been speaking with the book's author, Professor Michael Gambone. Really appreciate your time today.
And this was a treat, I got to tell you. Thank you.
So abortion is really the story of the day. We learned late last night, thanks to a Politico report, that the Supreme Court plans to overturn both Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and this will essentially do away with any kind of federal fundamental right to an abortion in most cases that women have. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the radical, repugnant, Trumpist congresswoman, made a really wild statement just a few days ago about abortion. I just haven't had time to get to it today, but I want to look at it. This was a comment made before we learned of the forthcoming Supreme Court decision, in which Marjorie Taylor Greene raises some really wacky religious stuff, where she says women get abortions because Satan comes up to them and whispers in their ear, "If you get the abortion, the guy who impregnated you will marry you," which of course ignores the reality that if you're pregnant because you've been raped, I don't know that you want the rapist to marry you. It's a vile, vile statement, but it shows us the level of religious delusion that exists for many of these people. Now, I will say again, earlier when we played the clip of Marjorie Taylor Greene crying because she was so happy by the Supreme Court decision that we learned about, I said, I think she's nuts. But if you believe abortion is murder, it's logical you would be very happy if abortion is ending. I understand that. This is just unhinged religious nuttery that is, you know, it's about angels and demons and ghosts and this type of stuff. Take a listen.
It's whispered softly and gently into your ears and into your soul. And he tells you it's okay. And he says it's just this one thing. You're just going to get it done, get it over with. And then he tells you a promise. He promises you all these dreams that you have in your heart. And that's how Satan sells a sin. And that's how he sells abortion. He tells a woman that all you have to do is you're just going to go to this clinic, just going to get it over with, you know. And then you're going to, that guy, he's going to stay with you. That boyfriend or the guy, whoever he is, he's going to marry you, sweep you off your feet.
So, first of all, this is so specific that it's extra strange. I'm not saying she's recounting a personal experience, but it is so specific that it is very weird. She seems to have no idea or concern with the reality that there are people in all sorts of situations who make really tough decisions about what is best for them. And sometimes it has to do with being a victim of sexual assault, rape. Sometimes it has to do with a fetus with an abnormality that would prevent ever having anything close to a normal and fulfilling life and would be suffering. Sometimes it's other things. The point is, it ignores, I mean, this is like psych ward stuff. And it ignores the reality of the circumstances in which sometimes women and families and couples choose to make really difficult decisions. But it's also paranormal and bizarre. And one of the unfortunate things is, you know, earlier I said, if you believe abortion is murder, it's logical you would be happy for it to stop. Okay, I understand that framework. On the other hand, if you are making decisions or having opinions about what civil law should be based on your evidence-free belief about angels, demons, ghosts, and Satan, it's hard to imagine you could ever be a productive and reasonable member of a legislative body, to put it quite frankly. And it's extraordinarily dangerous and it's extraordinarily disturbing. Let's talk about free speech. Truth Social, which Donald Trump misstated as Troth Social at a rally a week ago, it is the Trump social media platform, which the people on the right who like the platform promote as a free speech platform. Now, this should already set off an alarm in our heads, because most platforms describe themselves by what they are, not by the vague term free speech platform. So like YouTube is a video platform. I don't know exactly what their current tagline is, but it's the biggest video sharing site in the world. To call it a free speech platform would be kind of weird. It's a video platform, and they have terms of service that people have to abide by. Okay. Facebook is the biggest social whatever platform. Free speech platform, to me, would signal it's almost like a penis size contest, where it's something you say to get attention for that. And when we talk about Truth Social and we actually look at their terms of service, it turns out they have the exact same guidelines as any other platform. And so when I hear free speech platform, I think it's a platform for speech that they like. Check this out. Here are all of the different reasons that you can report a post on Truth Social based on their terms of service and terms and conditions. If you see illegal activity, content that depicts illegal or criminal acts or threats of violence. Okay, that's standard. Every platform has that. Intellectual property infringement, impersonating another account or business, infringing on intellectual property rights. Well, that's unadjudicated. So someone can just assert that there's some kind of infringement and you don't even go through due process to prove it and the content can be removed. Wow, that doesn't sound like the free speech platform they claim it to be, but it does sound like basically every other platform on the internet. Sensitive content. If there is violence, gore, or nudity, the content can be pulled. Oh, so like every other platform. If there's underage content, sexually explicit content involving underage children, oh, that's just like on YouTube, just like on Facebook, just like on Twitter. Prostitution, any solicitation or advertising for illegal sexual activity or sex for hire. Any privacy violation, if you violate or post content that violates a person's privacy rights, just like every other platform. Illegal sales, if you sell or promote illegal drugs, counterfeit services and goods, or illegal products and services. Wow, even counterfeit. Isn't it the buyer beware freedom for whoever wants to engage in commerce to decide, I want to buy this and maybe it's a fake product or not? But that's not exactly free speech. And lastly, doxing, sharing or threatening to share private information of individuals without their consent. So basically, it's a lot of cancel culture. Now, I'm joking. In reality, it's the exact same stuff we see on every platform. Interestingly, Truth Social has welcomed and become a sort of de facto safe haven for a lot of the people who supported the riots on January 6th, 2021, supported the coup, supported the insurrection. By their own terms of service, all of that information and depictions of what was done would have to be removed by Truth Social. And we have to understand that a free speech platform is a red alert alarm that they mean speech we like and are choosing to coddle. Now, after the disastrous launch of the platform, it seems as though now they've explained to Trump, sir, you've got to be a little more involved here. And Trump finally made his first post on Truth Social months after it launched. The message is, I'm back, hashtag Cobfefe. And it features a picture of Trump using his phone in front of Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. And it seems to have been potentially removed from Twitter. There was a picture of the post on Twitter. So it's not even really clear Trump cares about this thing. I think he knows there's not very many people on it. It's probably just another grift or cash grab. So Truth Social, not that much free speech. Trump's not even really on the platform, and it's yet another way to take advantage of their followers who seem more than thrilled about opportunities to be taken advantage of. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 2192-DAVID-P. I mentioned this a little bit earlier in our segment about the Supreme Court apparently imminently overturning Roe v. Wade. Here's a caller who's thinking along some similar lines that I am. Take a listen to this.
Hi, David. This is Keisha from Florida. The Supreme Court just put out a notice to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
Do you think same-sex marriages and interracial marriages is next? I would love to hear your commentary. Thank you.
Yeah. So, like I said earlier, I don't know whether there will develop a concerted effort to end interracial marriage at the state level or to end gay marriage, or I can't say for sure that that's where energy is going to be focused. But some of the people who are against abortion are also against those things. And there's nothing that will more invigorate these reactionary movements than getting what they see as a win. And this was a win that took a while. Like I said earlier, it took Trump had to win in 2016, get his first opportunity to put a Supreme Court justice on the court, the second one, the third one. Then you needed to see these state level abortion bans start to be put together, and then to be fought, and then to be appealed to the court. And then the court had to take one of those cases. And okay, so it's a process, but it is a win for them. There's no question about it. And so in general, when you get an inch, you then try to take a mile. And I absolutely think there will be some movement to go further and go beyond just stopping abortion. I don't know if it'll be interracial marriage, gay marriage, rules about employment, or whatever else the case may be, but they aren't going to stop here. That's for sure. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Campaign season is on. We have primaries today in Ohio and in some other places. And there are many more primaries this month. We're going to talk about the midterms are now happening on the bonus show. We will talk about another Supreme Court decision in which the Supreme Court has found that First Amendment rights were violated when a group wanted to put a Christian flag outside of City Hall. We'll talk about that. And what Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has been doing at the border between Texas and Mexico has turned out to be an extraordinary economic opportunity for the state of New Mexico. We will talk about what's going on there as well. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You will get instant access to the bonus show. You'll get the commercial-free audio and video streams of the show. Don't wait all day for clips to be released of the show. You'll get the entire show commercial-free hours earlier than everybody else when you become a member at joinpacman.com. I'll see you on the bonus show or otherwise tomorrow. And reminder, Wednesday night, May 4th, I will be live with the next Pennsylvania Senate Republican debate. That's the one with Mehmet Oz, the guy who suggests quack cures on TV, and other Republicans running for the Republican nomination in that race. Tomorrow night, we'll be live with that as well. See everybody soon.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to our little experiment in freeform radio.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. We'll be right back.
Quand même c'est une patate, un poule maigre d'éclatant.